United forever in friendship and labor, our mighty republics will ever endure. The great Soviet Union.
The 1945 movie called Victory Parade featured the great Paul Robeson singing the Soviet Union national anthem.
Long live our Soviet motherland, built by the people's mighty hand.
Robeson was fluent in Russian. He first traveled to the Soviet Union in 1934 in the pre-Cold War era at the invitation of a Soviet filmmaker. He was one of many prominent American black activists and artists who visited during that time, drawn by the reputed racial tolerance of the new nation and its effort to put Marxist ideas into practice. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, the story of a less well-known African American who lived and worked in the Soviet Union during this period.
Long may our crimson flag inspire, shining in glory for all men to see.
Later in the show, the 23 American POWs in North Korea who stunned the nation by refusing to come home.
The biggest victory comes for China. China is a new nation, a communist nation, and I think everybody was pretty shocked that Americans, bathed in capitalism and liberty, could be enticed to the dark side.
But first, during the Great Depression, the Soviet Union actively recruited African-American intellectuals with offers of high salaries and social freedom. My first guests today are making a film about the life of one of the young black men who heeded the call to live and work there. The filmmakers are John Bachman and Marion Vini Ashton. John is the public events manager at the birthplace of Robert E. Lee, Stratford Hall. Marion is the director of the nearby A.T. Johnson Museum. They're calling the film in progress From Kremlin to Kremlin, the Joseph Roane story. Joseph Roane was a young agronomist trained at Virginia State University. His remarkable journey began when he and his new wife left their tiny community in Kremlin, Virginia, and moved to the cotton fields of Uzbekistan and Stalinist Russia, and then back again to Kremlin, Virginia. John, tell me why this man, Joseph Roane, would be lured to the Soviet Union to work for the new communist regime there. What would impel him to leave his family and community in this rustic county, Westmoreland County, Virginia?
Hey, he is starting a new life with his wife, Sadie. He is a person that is thinking about his future. He may not be as politically motivated as I thought, but he had his future well in mind.
Marion, do you think he was lured, though, by this idea of an egalitarian society where he wouldn't have to worry about whites and blacks and racial discrimination?
According to Joe himself, no. He went there because he wanted to provide the best he could for his wife.
And this was during the Great Depression. Did he think, hey, this is a great job?
I'm pretty sure he did, because had he stayed in Virginia, $90 a month does not equate to $600 a month. And that was the salary that he was going to get going to Russia.
John, what else were Joseph and the other African Americans in America offered by the communists to lure them over?
Well, I mean, it was job security. You were employed. He was promised a housekeeper. He was promised a paid vacation. This was unheard of in the African American community.
And what did they want him to do? What was his job going to be?
Well, he was an agronomist, and one of his specialties was cotton industry. And one of the crucial industries to Stalin at the time was to raise the production across the board. They simply couldn't produce enough cotton to keep up with the demands of the new Soviet society.
His family for generations had been landowners, so farming was not only his passion, it had been for generations the backbone of the economy for his family.
It's so interesting, Westmoreland County. This is a county somewhat famous for being the birthplace of George Washington, the birthplace of Robert E. Lee. How interesting that this African-American family were landowners.
there were many freed blacks that owned land in Westmoreland County and throughout the tidewater of Virginia.
We forget that Westmoreland County didn't always have slaves. Westmoreland County had indentured servants. Once you paid off your indentured servitude, you could become a landowner, and that's how a lot of people acquired land.
So what lured Joseph Roan to the Soviet Union? There was an African-American man who'd been there, had been trained by the new communist regime, who said, go back and get us other African-Americans to be part of our new adventure.
Oliver Golden is a person, very interesting. After his training in Moscow, he was instructed to go back to the United States. He would then contact the brightest minds in the African-American community and recruit them on an adventure and an opportunity at a time when both of those things, especially the opportunity, really would ring true for a young college graduate.
But the other thing with Oliver Golden, he fell in love with Russia because he fell out of love with the United States. He had gone to college, had a degree. The only job that he could secure was either a porter or working on a farm for minimal wages. He did not think that should be his life. So when he went to New York and he found that even the prejudiceness that he thought he was going to escape by leaving Ohio, they followed him to New York because he fell in love with a Jewish girl. And the African-Americans, they are like, this is not going to work. The whites in New York is, this is not going to work. You fit nowhere. So they decided to move to Russia because of the attraction of no racial separation in Russia.
And some of the most famous African-Americans of the time did the same thing. Didn't Paul Robeson go
over? Exactly. It was the mecca for the talented to go to Russia to be treated in Russia as they wanted to be treated in their mother country.
How many African-Americans do you think went over to the Soviet Union in the late 20s, early 30s?
Into the hundreds. Many of them never came back. And what is so rare is the story of Joseph and the fact that he came back, because most didn't.
And you think that was mostly luck, that he could not have seen how awful the Stalin purges were to become?
It's hard for me to believe that he didn't know that these things were going on. Joseph didn't conduct a lot of interviews. He did conduct a few, and that always came up. Were you either A, attracted to communism? Were you a member of the Communist Party? And did you know about the oppressive terror strategies that the Stalinist government did? He would say, no, I really wasn't a communist. Look, I did the best I could for my family. By 1935 and 1936, the original first five-year plan that Stalin had implemented, the economic great leap forward for the Soviet Union, was failing. That's when the true terror of the gulags, the prison camps, the Siberian death camps were used. It is a terrible and frightful story of what Stalin would do to his own people.
I want to ask you about what we know about what Stalin wanted to achieve by bringing African Americans to Soviet Union.
Well, there was a huge propaganda contest, if you will, between the United States and the Soviet Union at the time. There was no question that the United States was going through its worst economic depression in its history. The Soviet Union decided to use this as a propaganda tool to convince African Americans and other Americans that the freedom and equality that they offered was attainable in the Soviet Union. It was generally not believed or supported by the African Americans in the United States, who never rallied to the call.
It did seem to resonate, however, with the intellectual and arts elite in the African American community.
This is true. The arts elite saw things in a different light. And what they told them was, we can do so much more for you. You will be the person that you've always dreamed of becoming. But the other thing about the Roan story that is very interesting is that they, Joseph and Sadie, had the very first African-American baby born in the country.
Yosef Stalin Kim Rowan was his official name. He was born in Tashkent, 1932.
And why Joseph Stalin?
Because out of tribute to the opportunity to go over to the Soviet Union.
Why did they decide to come back?
They came back because Joseph's mother was sick.
He was lucky to get out.
He was lucky.
This fellow, Oliver Golden, who had recruited Joseph to go over to the Soviet Union to begin with, narrowly missed being picked up by the secret police and sent off to the prison camps in Siberia.
After Joseph returned to the United States, in addition to teaching, did he make a name for himself as the years went by?
Almost immediately upon his return, he started making a name for himself, bringing back to Virginia those farming techniques that he had perfected. He would go around from store to store, little rural country stores, every Saturday, holding court for both black and white to teach them how to crop, how to turn over their crops, how to just make sure that they were planting at the right time.
I think he brought back some of that sense of purpose and community that he picked up in the Soviet Union. I've had the opportunity to visit a building that he helped make, which was a community center in Westmoreland County.
What about the young son? So he was 6 years old. Was he bilingual when he returned to the small rural community?
No, absolutely not. He only spoke Russian.
Okay.
And that was so funny because even his classmates would say he would come in and he was very quiet because he didn't know what they were saying and they didn't know what he was saying. And he tells the story that the only time he heard English being spoken was when his parents were saying something they didn't want him to know. So this was not a language that was spoken in his household in Russia.
Do you know Yosef?
I do know Yosef. And he is a wonderful gentleman farmer. He manages the Roan farming enterprise.
Well, I can remember the first time that I saw him, and he walks up to the podium and says to the audience, "I bet none of you have ever heard of Uzbekistan." And then there was a pause, and he says, "Because I was born there."
He doesn't remember, and we don't know anything about what his experience was there, right?
Well, he does remember some things, being scared by Soviet soldiers. He also remembers certain incidences in barber shops and comments that people would make. An African American was very unusual.
The one thing that Joseph always told all of us, he never experienced racism except for one time. And that's when he was in the barbershop and someone else came in while he was getting his hair cut. And they made the statement, you know, "Why is this in here getting a haircut?" And the barber threw that person out. And according to Joseph, this was the first and only time that he experienced any semblance of racism.
When people like Joseph and Sadie came back, do you think there were any of the ideals or the traits that were the best of what was intended by this new society that they were able to instill in people around them?
I think there was. When I was shown the community center that he built, which was now covered with vines and overgrown and things like that, and learned about how extensive and caring he was amongst his community, and maybe I was just projecting my own thoughts on it, that he came back with a sense of responsibility to a community.
Well, some of the well-known African Americans during this era who did go to the Soviet Union were vilified when they came back to the United States for having communed with the communists. He escaped that vilification because he was less well-known?
No, I think he escaped that vilification because, as far as we know, he was not a communist. And he never professed to be anything coming back than he was when he left. Joseph Rowan from Kremlin.
What's the value of this film, Kremlin to Kremlin? What can we achieve with it?
I think one of the things that I would like the takeaway to be is this little rural community of Virginia that produced this person to give him the thirst to want to be all that he could be, even if he had to leave the country to do that. Because the same tenacity that he took to Russia, to develop their newly formed country. He came back to Kremlin and he put that same drive into making it the best that it could be.
One of the things that I have noticed ever since I began working with Marianne on different projects was that as we uncover more and more history of the African-American community in Westmoreland County, how little of it is known by the white community. And yet, when I sat at a program honoring Joseph's life last August, it was one testimonial after another from the African-American community. This is a type of bridge experience, I believe, that is critical as we understand each other and each other's ethnicity. This is absolutely important. And I think these stories, there are thousands of these stories across
absolutely.
The country. I think there are stories like this that need to be shared and discussed and brought up, because it's really going to be this that's going to help us better understand who we are and where do we want to go as a society.
Marianne Veeney Ashton is the director of the A.T. Johnson Museum, and John Bachman is the public events manager at Stratford Hall, the birthplace of Robert E. Lee. They're making a film called From Kremlin to Kremlin, the Joseph Rhone Story. Coming up next, the American POWs from the Korean War who didn't want to come home. More than 7,000 American soldiers were taken prisoner during the Korean War, and nearly 3,000 of them died in captivity. Their long ordeal came to an end at midnight on January 24, 1954, when the last step was taken in the armistice to end the war in Korea. But during the 4 months prior to the armistice, news had spread in America, then throughout the world, that a group of 23 American POWs were refusing to come home. Brian McKnight tells their story in a new book, We Fight for Peace. Brian is a professor of history at the University of Virginia's College at Wise. At the end of the hostilities, you write that both sides were set to release their captives simultaneously, and then what happened?
Toward the end of Big Switch, which was in very late August 53, very early September, we realized that we've got some people who are refusing to return for one reason or another.
What is your understanding of why most of them didn't want to go back to America yet?
Well, that's where it gets really complex. There were two or three of those prisoners who were homosexuals and afraid of some sort of retribution. A lot of these guys were collaborators. Some were outright collaborators. And they had been told that if you get on that boat to go back to Hawaii, you won't get off. You know, there's a lot of open ocean out there we can throw you off into. We've got to understand that, you know, in the POW experience, collaborating might be a matter of life or death for someone else. If somebody is hoarding food or has a weapon or something else, a collaborator might get them in big trouble. There were a lot of stories of prisoners being made to stand barefoot on ice for hours at a time as punishment. And you do that, and then you come down with pneumonia and you die, you know, in one way or the other. Maybe the collaborator is actually a murderer as far as his fellow prisoners are concerned.
How big a deal was it back home and around the world that some of the American prisoners of war didn't want to come home?
Oh, it was a pretty big deal. The New York Times begins running front page articles about a lot of these guys. Internationally, it's also pretty big, but the biggest victory comes for China. China is a new nation, a communist nation. And here you have these 23 guys accepting China and Chinese communism. This is a huge victory for a nation like China. And I think everybody was pretty shocked that Americans, bathed in capitalism and liberty, could be enticed to the dark side.
The Americans were able to coax a couple of them back home, right?
Yeah. In mid-October 1953, Edward Dickinson, who was a corporal from Big Stone Gap, Virginia, chose to be repatriated and came home as a celebrity. A couple of months later, the news breaks that Claude Batchelor, from Kermit, Texas, has also chosen to repatriate. And those will be the only two who will voluntarily repatriate.
And was the government or the military promising these men, look, if you come back, here's what we'll give you?
Well, one of the contentions is that these men were promised immunity. Legally speaking, they weren't promised immunity, but considering the education level of these guys, they would have had to have a lawyer with them to understand that. One of the things the Chinese did was they had people sign peace petitions, and then they would ask them to circulate peace petitions back home. And they would tell them, you know, we'll let you write a letter home, but you've got to send a peace plea, you know, to mom, dad, call the governor, tell him this war is unjust. And once you get a lot of that stuff filtering back home, there are a lot of people who are wondering, you know, maybe the war is unjust. And as a result of that, you have some very nervous politicians, and we have to remember this is smack dab in the midst of McCarthyism.
The national mood was communism was terrifying, and a bewilderment over how you could have good, upright American soldiers turning like this.
Yes. And one of the funny things about this is at the time these men went to Korea to fight in 1950, Joe McCarthy hadn't yet emerged. And by the time they return home, McCarthy is in full flower than they remember leaving.
How much media attention was paid to these guys, to these men when they came back to America? How reviled were they, or were there sympathetic stories?
Actually, most of the stories are sympathetic. They lived in sub-zero weather for 6 months out of the year with virtually nothing to clothe them. They slept in cramped little buildings that were so tightly packed that if one man turned over, everybody else had to also. There's plenty of opportunity to make your life better. If your friend is sick and he has dysentery and the Chinese have a pill that will eliminate the dysentery and he's going to give you an opportunity to make a deal for that pill. You come to indoctrination sessions, you sign these peace petitions, and I'll save your friend's life. If you don't, your friend dies. And there were a lot of people who came out in local newspapers and said, you know, before you pass judgment on somebody like Dickinson, you know, you have to appreciate what he went through for 3 years.
What had he gone through?
A lot of starvation, a lot of cold. Dickinson was never a big guy, but he probably went from about 140 pounds down to about 90 pounds within the first 6 months or so of captivity. Most of us who want to lose weight go on a 2,000 calorie diet. They're on 800 calories. And these are calories made up of rice balls and millet, basically what we would consider to be animal feed, maybe with a fish head or something mixed in a soup. And they begin to suffer from what fellow POWs called give-up-itis. They won't even eat the food that's provided them. They'd rather die.
And some did.
Many did, particularly in the first 6 months or so. The Chinese had entered the war so quickly, they really didn't know what to do with all these guys. They captured thousands of POWs in the first week of their entry into the war.
So what did happen to the 21 former POWs that decided to defect to China? What were their experiences there, and did they eventually come back?
Well, actually, they did. They were taken to China, and China very much enjoyed showing them around and treating them like visiting dignitaries. But then China had a problem. They didn't know what to do with them. They sent some of them to college, taught them Chinese language, primarily used many of them for several years at a place called the Foreign Language Institute, where they would translate Chinese communist literature into American or English language literature. Many of them who just did not have the academic ability were put out on farms and made to drive tractors and that sort of thing. In 1955, you start to see the first repatriates return.
Did we welcome them back?
Actually, we welcomed them back by arresting them. The U.S. Army placed them under arrest in San Francisco, and the Army intends to court-martial them. After they're held for a few weeks, the U.S. Supreme Court finds that the Army does not have any authority to do that, since it did dishonorably discharge them. And going back earlier in the story, Batchelor and Dickinson, who were placed under arrest shortly after the repatriation deadline, they had been arrested and tried, mainly on the strength that the Army had not discharged those two.
Huh. So it felt very unfair to be imprisoned when you see the others who did just what you did walk free.
Well, even worse than that, I've always looked at it like the two guys who wanted to return home and took the risk were arrested and tried and convicted and sentenced and imprisoned, while the remainder who refused to come home and only did so after they realized how difficult life was in China were able to walk as free men.
In your book, you have a message to the families and friends of the 23 men who were disgraced after they were captured by the enemy in Korea. You wrote, "Do not dismiss them or be ashamed of their actions," although many were. Why did you write it?
Well, a lot of their children still don't know the stories. You know, so many of these guys are now dead or at least very old, and they didn't necessarily tell their kids these stories. So there's a lot of negativity there. But I think that what we can do is we can try to learn from them and try to appreciate the situation that they were involved in and the suffering that they went through, and maybe develop a greater respect for not just them, but all the men who had to suffer through these sorts of trials. You know, it's really easy for us to fantasize about the valorous position we would take in these circumstances. But when somebody holds your entire life in the palm of their hand, which the Chinese did for 3 years, it gets a lot more complicated. Or at least it does to me.
From mother's arms to Korea, and tomorrow I'll face the front line. Then the next line was wrote by his buddy. From a foxhole to a mansion on high, they sent her an unfinished diary that she once gave.
Brian McKnight is a professor of history at the University of Virginia's College at Wise. His new book is We Fight for Peace. This is With Good Reason. We'll be right back.
From mother's arms to Korea, and tomorrow I'll face the front line.
Welcome back to With Good Reason. I'm Sarah McConnell. Right in the face of the misery and terror of the Great Depression, along came an energetic, optimistic, and supremely confident new president, Franklin Roosevelt.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat into advance.
My next two guests spoke at a conference on FDR held by the Center for American Studies at Christopher Newport University. Pulitzer Prize-winning Roosevelt biographer David M. Kennedy of Stanford University gave the keynote address.
In my view, there have been three deeply transformational events in all of American history. The first is the obvious one, the moment of the Revolutionary War for Independence and the drafting of the Constitution. Second is the Civil War and Reconstruction. And the third, in my view, is the period of the Great Depression, the New Deal, and World War II. And it fell to Franklin Roosevelt to be the president who presided over the third and most recent of these great transformative events in the 1930s and 1940s. It fell to him to assume leadership in the midst of the greatest economic crisis the country has ever seen, to rewrite the terms of the social contract in ways that I'll try to spell out in the so-called New Deal, and to lead this society to victory along with its allies, in the greatest of all modern wars, World War II. Now, my subject, Franklin Roosevelt, I suppose like all of us, was a complex person, only more so than usual. Even among his closest associates, notably Frances Perkins, serving for 12 years as his Secretary of Labor, even she remained baffled by him to the end. In her post-World War II memoir, she said of Roosevelt, "He was the most complicated human being I ever knew." And many other contemporaries famously misunderstood or underestimated him. Now, perhaps the most telling comment on Roosevelt's personality by a contemporary was allegedly delivered by the venerable Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. On the morning of Roosevelt's inauguration on March 4, 1933, the president-elect, on his way to the inaugural event, made a courtesy call at Holmes' home. When Roosevelt departed after having tea and cookies and exchanging a few pleasantries, Holmes allegedly turned to his law clerk and offered this famous appraisal of Franklin Roosevelt. He said, "A second-class intellect, but a first-class temperament." So, what was that temperament, and what were its consequences for American history, and I dare say for the lives of people sitting in this room today? Well, I'm going to suggest to you that there are four words that I think summarize a lot about Roosevelt's temperament and capture much of its essence. And the words are simply absorptive, sunny, self-confident, and the most consequential, I think, is responsible. Start with absorptive. Virtually all of Roosevelt's associates testified about what they all remarked was his boundless appetite for knowledge and his remarkable capacity to assimilate it and store it in his core memory, though many also found it curious that he apparently never read a book. Conversation was his craft and the natural medium through which he absorbed his knowledge of the world. But he could listen too, and his mind may have appeared to some observers to be disorderly, but all agreed that it was prodigiously well-stocked. Adolph Burley, who was one of the original brain trusters or advisors to Roosevelt in the 32 campaign and the early New Deal, was one of many people who were simply awed by the range of Roosevelt's interests. And he put it this way. He said, "Roosevelt had an almost universal interest. There were few fields of knowledge with which he had no contact, many in which he was expert, but in all he had a vivid interest. Nothing was alien to him." So Roosevelt might have been born into a highly privileged and sheltered enclave of American society, but unlike so many members of his social class, he was no smug, self-satisfied, parochial country squire, but he was a man with insatiable curiosity about the world, and apparently unslakable interest in other people from whatever walk of life. Okay, sunny. The record overflows with testimonials to his infectious optimism, his charm, his garrulousness, and with that, his uncanny ability to project his personality through skillful employment of what was then the quite new-fangled medium of radio. He gave the first fireside chat on the first Sunday after his inauguration on March 12, 1933, and millions of Americans tuned in on their newfangled radio sets, and they heard the voice of a master showman, cultivated but not condescending, commanding and yet avuncular and warm, masterful and at the same time intimate. In the week following that address, some 450,000 Americans wrote to the president. The White House mailroom had been staffed by one single person. Given this deluge of mail that came in the week after the first fireside chat, the White House mailroom had to hire 70 people to handle not just that week's correspondence, but a stream of correspondence at that level that continued over the next decade and more. Now, with respect to the next of his traits, self-confidence, it has been said that Roosevelt's utterly untroubled conception of the office of the presidency consisted quite simply of the thought of himself in it. And indeed, his administrations arguably created the benchmark definition for the role of the president for every person who has followed him. Now, the sources of that really deep and unshakable confidence in himself, brings me to the fourth of his temperamental traits, the one I've described as the most consequential, and that is his sense of responsibility. Now, others have used different language to describe this trait. Some have called it a sense of noblesse oblige, or a sense of patrician duty, or seigneurial solicitude, this attitude he had about the country as his own possession and his countrymen as his wards. Now, much of that sense of duty and responsibility, noblesse oblige, patrician duty, whatever you want to call it, was, I suppose, one has to imagine, instilled by his parents, who doted on him as their only child. And that sense of obligation, again, noblesse oblige, was sternly reinforced by his schooling at a very impressionable age at Groton. And under the circumstances of his upbringing, both familial and at school, it was all but inevitable, one supposes, that Roosevelt would enter public service. He also had, in my judgment, a coherent view about the purposes of public life and about his own political mission. Now, Roosevelt, of course, was not alone in trying to make historical sense out of the Great Depression. Many people in this country and elsewhere appraised the crisis not simply as another economic downturn, but in fact as the climax of a long historical epoch that was tolling the knell for capitalism and liberal democracy as bankrupt or hopelessly obsolete historical artifacts. That is one of the great lessons, I think, that the study of history can give us. And I think Roosevelt had studied history sufficiently that he understood this was that kind of a moment. The result is what history knows as the New Deal. The New Deal gave to millions of Americans who had never had much of it before a sense of security, and with that came a sense of having a stake in their country. As Roosevelt himself once put it, "We are going to make a country in which no one is left out." When Roosevelt spoke, as he did in his second inaugural address in January of 1937, of one-third of a nation ill-housed, ill-clad, and ill-nourished, I'm quoting still, of the millions denied education, recreation, and the opportunity to better their lot and the lot of their children, and that one-third of a nation he's talking about are not the unemployed in the Depression. They're the stubborn, persistent one-third of the country that's been left out of the mainstream of American life for a century. He was referring to most farmers, many members of those immigrant communities that I mentioned earlier, and virtually all African Americans. Okay, time, or I should say more precisely, the lack of time, prohibits an extensive discussion of Roosevelt's role in World War II, but let me just touch on some highlights. This was a time of huge and fearsome uncertainty, especially after France rather ingloriously genuflected in front of Hitler's blitzkrieg attack in June of 1940. Would Britain now survive? Now, on May 15th, 1940, the then newly installed British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, formally asked President Roosevelt for help in the war against Hitler. What could he do? The American people were decidedly isolationist, one of my several beefs with the characterization of them as the greatest generation. Roosevelt's ambassador to Great Britain, Joseph P. Kennedy, the father of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, said aid in Britain will leave the United States to hold the bag for a war in which the Allies expect to be beaten. The United States Army Chief of Staff, General George C. Marshall, advised just a few days later, "We cannot afford to submit ourselves to the delay and consequences involved in accommodating the British government." And just to complicate things further, 1940 was a presidential election year, not the kind of circumstance that usually conduces to nurturing political courage. Yet in the teeth of all that contrary advice, Roosevelt and Roosevelt alone insisted on delivering American military production to the British and on revising the neutrality statutes to create the so-called Lend-Lease Act. A less self-confident man might have yielded to his advisors and kept the United States out of the whole affair. So small wonder that at the end of the war, Winston Churchill said in a speech in Parliament, he said, "The United States at this moment stand at the summit of the world." Though I have not sought here to beatify Roosevelt and surely not to canonize him, but I do think that his qualities of intellectual curiosity, optimism, self-confidence, and his deep understanding of history, as well as his willingness to shoulder weighty responsibilities that would take advantage of the possibilities in that historical moment, surely shaped his era deeply. History must in the end credit him with about as close a thing to three miracles of leadership as any president can claim. One, wringing last and, in my judgment, beneficial reform out of the crisis of the Depression. Two, shepherding his reluctant people into what history can only judge on balance to have been a just and necessary war. And third, achieving a victory in that war that sheltered Americans from the worst of the war's ravages and positioned them for prosperity and international leadership for half a century and more thereafter. That's a pretty impressive achievement. Thank you.
That was David Kennedy, Professor of History Emeritus at Stanford University, speaking at the Center for American Studies at Christopher Newport University. Next, we'll hear from Sid Milkus on Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. Sid Milkus is the White Burkett Miller Professor in the Department of Politics at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. Sid, when did Franklin Roosevelt first put forth his idea for the New Deal?
Well, he really first developed his ideas for the New Deal during the 32 campaign era, when he, of course, first ran for president during the height of the Depression. Now, just picture the situation, 30% unemployment, much higher in the cities, nearly 50%, say, in Chicago. The banking industry had completely shut down.
What was the crux of the argument that he was making?
That the time had come to redefine the social contract. What Herbert Hoover described as rugged individualism, that is individual responsibility, limited government. And that idea remained really powerful even through the crisis of a civil war. But the Industrial Revolution really challenged it. And the Great Depression gave Franklin Roosevelt the opportunity to present to the American people a different idea of rights, which he called the economic constitutional order. And what that meant, Sarah, was that the time had come in the face of terrifying economic insecurity for the government to guarantee individual men and women protection from these terrifying insecurities. The time had come to provide individuals with economic and social welfare.
Did he base the New Deal on something that had come before but failed?
Yeah, Roosevelt was very much influenced by his second cousin, Theodore Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt had addressed the hardships of the Industrial Revolution during his presidency, and he defined a program called the Square Deal, which called for the government to help individuals in these times when there had become such a strong concentration of economic power in the form of these corporations.
How did he differ? How did he change Theodore's approach and ideas so that he was successful?
The most important difference is Theodore Roosevelt was a manly man who believed in duty and responsibility. So against this powerful idea of individual rights, Theodore Roosevelt had preached the importance of the American people to embrace an idea of national community. And that worked pretty well, but it also scared the hell out of a lot of Americans because it threatened the core principles of the Declaration of Independence, the idea of individual autonomy. Now, what Franklin Roosevelt recognized was that if we were going to redefine the social contract, it had to be interwoven into the fabric of the American idea of rights. And so rather than threatening the natural rights tradition, this notion that individuals have rights as part of their soul and independent of the government, Roosevelt called for the expansion of rights and argued that it's crazy to suggest that somebody has individual liberty when they are desperately poor, when they don't have a job, when their hard-earned savings in the bank could disappear overnight. And as Roosevelt put it at Madison Square Garden when he accepted the nomination of the Democratic Party for re-election, necessitous men are not free men.
What were the strongest objections to the New Deal and to what Franklin Roosevelt was doing? What were his opponents? What case were they making about why this was not the right course for America?
Right from the get-go, when the New Deal's taking shape, the Republican Party is strongly opposed to it. The people who represented their voices, like Herbert Hoover and Alf Landon, the governor of Kansas, who was Roosevelt's opponent in 1936, they warn the American people that Roosevelt, although he's talking about rights, is radically transforming the American sense of values. They felt that even in the dire time, Sarah, we could not sacrifice individual freedom. That would be too high a cost. And what Landon argued in the 36 campaign, what was so pernicious about Social Security was it didn't trust the American people to plan for their own retirement.
So what is the New Deal? The New Deal was Social Security taxes and a promise down the road that you'll be taken care of?
Yeah. Lincoln called for a fair race of life. Roosevelt's New Deal was rooted in the understanding that nobody should really lose the race so much that they're completely defeated, because a completely defeated man or woman is not really a free man or woman. The key idea was the Social Security program. This was enacted after a two-year political campaign, so to speak, carried out by Roosevelt in 1935. There were three key parts to the program. One, funds that would protect people against the insecurities of old age, so to speak, a government-provided pension system, protection against unemployment, an unemployment program, and then a third part, which is aid for the impoverished, aid for families with dependent children, it was called. And that was the most controversial part of the program and remained the smallest part of the program until it was repealed in 1996. But the part of the program that became really interwoven into the fabric of American values was the protection against old age, which is what we really think of when we say Social Security, protecting grandma and grandpa from poverty. And before this program was passed, Sarah, poverty was a huge problem for senior citizens. Another very, very important New Deal program is the GI Bill. And what the GI Bill did was to provide programs that would guarantee the economic security of veterans. And given the magnitude of the Second World War, given how many soldiers came home, this had a tremendous impact on American society.
Was the civil service also part of the New Deal?
Yeah. The bureaucracy was very small before the New Deal. Some 200,000 government workers who came to put in place the New Deal programs, they came as temporary workers. But Roosevelt in 1940 got through Congress something called the Ramspeck Act, which provided civil service protection, that is, gave permanent jobs to those 200,000 New Deal workers. So they were now locked in place and became an enduring part of the federal government. And so Social Security is administered by loyal New Dealers who very carefully and effectively nurture it so that it comes to fulfill the hopes that Roosevelt had for it. It's not just that Roosevelt gives life to an idea and it takes form automatically. You needed people to establish government institutions that would make those programs effective.
And to secure the New Deal, Roosevelt even enlisted the aid of Norman Rockwell.
Yeah. Norman Rockwell had expressed some interest in illustrating the Four Freedoms. And he was invited to the White House for sketchings. So he did a series of paintings with the encouragement of the White House, which illustrated the Four Freedoms. In 1943, over 4 weeks, the Four Freedoms are portrayed on the cover of the Saturday Evening Post, and everybody gets to view them. The most famous one is Freedom from Want. It's a beautiful New England scene of a Thanksgiving dinner. And there's a big turkey, of course,
yeah,
and a really wholesome-looking extended family sitting around a table enjoying each other's company, and there's three generations present. And then there's Freedom from Fear, probably the second most famous illustration. What it depicts, Sarah, is a couple tucking their young children into bed. The father is holding a newspaper as he's tucking his children into bed. And you can't quite make out what the headline is, but you can see that it's about the Nazis bombing. If we can't protect families from this kind of fear, then how can we talk about liberty? Now, one of the things I've always found fascinating about the Social Security program is the way Roosevelt designed it as a right, to be as something that would become as sacred as freedom of speech. The way he did this, in part, was the way the Social Security system was taxed. As anybody whose work knows, you have payroll taxes taken out, which goes into your Social Security program. Economists argued this was the wrong way to do it, that the more efficient, fairer way to do it, particularly for those who had less money, was to take the money from general revenues and not base it on the payroll tax. And Roosevelt said, well, you know, that may make economic sense, but this isn't about economics. This is politics all the way through. And as long as I base the Social Security program on the payroll tax and people think of it as their pension, as something they should get as a right, then he said, and this is a quote, no damn politician will ever be able to scrap my Social Security program. And that was incredibly prescient because that's pretty much what happened, that Social Security became what we now talk about as an entitlement, as a right. What was different about Social Security, it was a structural change to make sure that what happened during the Depression would never happen again.
That was Sid Milka speaking at the Center for American Studies FDR Conference at Christopher Newport University. He's a professor of politics at the Miller Center at the University of Virginia. Major support for With Good Reason is provided by an anonymous donor. Support also comes from the law firm of McGuire Woods. With Good Reason is produced by the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Elliot Majerzyk, Kelly Libby, and Allison Quantz are our associate producers. Our assistant producer is Lilia Fuchin. Andrew Windham is our executive producer. And Jeannie Palin handles listener services. To hear the show again, go to withgoodreasonradio.org. For a free copy of the show on a CD, call 877-451-5098. I'm Sarah McConnell. Thanks for listening.